You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Hello, welcome please to Telstra Customer Service. How may I be helping you?
Conform or be consumed.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history.
I heard a rumour today.
I like your rumours.
I know, as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school, how can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
What is your environmental policy?
To sell Telstra.
You heard of road rage?
Yes.
What about web rage?
And within a few minutes.
Minutes?
Yeah, minutes. It's not minutes. XG, mate.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello everyone and welcome to this week's edition of Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. Last week we talked about the launch of Australia's Do Not Call register. In the past week, over 500,000 Australians have registered their phone number so as not to be harassed by telemarketers. And like the Honourable Senator Helen Coonan, I'd call this a good result for its first week. But more importantly, it raises the issue that Australians really value their privacy and they want to return to a time that when the phone rang, there were family, friends or colleagues on the other end, and rightly so. Also this week, in a move to counter piracy, Warner Brothers will offer movie downloads online through video online communications in Hong Kong, a key movie market where film piracy is rampant. As the internet gets faster, one has to ask, is this the start of things to come? Like the music market has embraced online sites where users can download a single song to a whole album, video is set to go the same way. Right now, thanks to the video codec DivX, a feature film can be compressed to as little as 700 megabytes while maintaining DVD quality pictures. An ADSL2 or even an uncapped ADSL1 subscriber can download a file like this in 20 minutes or less and burn it to a CD or DVD. Most modern DVD players will play the DivX file, which has an AVI extension, without any problems whatsoever. Who'd want to own a Blockbuster or Video Easy shop these days?
This week on Tech Talk Radio.
ICANN looks at new domains. Adam Turner looks at the Telstra spin. We catch up with Lydia Davis in Palo Alto. Australia's Do Not Call register off to a good start. Microsoft out to lure students to their office product. YouTube yields to a royal presence. And Robert Broomhead, director of the Wireless Institute of Australia, joins the panel to talk to us about the state of amateur radio in Australia. All that and more on Australia's premier tech talk show, Tech Talk Radio. But first, let's find out what's been making news in the tech world this week.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, telcos holding us back, ICANN mulls new net domains, Australia's Do Not Call register cracks 500,000, and a man appeals a net piracy jail term. Welcome to Tech Talk News. A new study has revealed that iPods can cause cardiac implantable pacemakers to malfunction by interfering with the electromagnetic equipment monitoring the heart. A 17-year-old high school student presented the study to a meeting of heart specialists last Thursday. The study tested the effect of the portable music devices on 100 patients whose mean age was 77, outfitted with pacemakers. Electrical interference was detected half the time when the iPod was just 2 inches from the patient's chest for 5 to 10 seconds. The study did not examine any portable music devices other than iPods, which are made by Apple. In some cases, the iPod caused interference when held 18 inches from the chest. Interference with the telemetry equipment caused the device to misread the heart's pacing and in one case caused the pacemaker to stop functioning altogether. Australia's effort to improve its competitiveness has stalled with a poor performance in telecommunications infrastructure, hampering the nation's potential. The World Competitiveness Scoreboard for 2007, released in Switzerland last week, says Australia needs better foundations for economic growth in an increasingly competitive world. Compiled before this week's budget, the study by Swiss Business School IMD says Australia must do more to reform its education system, promote higher educational skill levels, and encourage greater business innovation and technology use. New internet addresses for general use could start appearing in the summer of 2008 under a new timeline the internet's key oversight agency has announced. The Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, ICANN, has invited public comment on procedures for creating new names, the first expansion for general use since 2000. Names added since then have been limited to specific regions or industries. ICANN Chief Executive Paul Twomey said in a statement, "This is all about choice. We want the diversity of the world's people, geography and businesses to be able to be represented in the domain name system." Domain names are key for helping computers find websites and route email. There are currently about 250 domain name suffixes, most of them for specific countries such as .fr for France, general use names such as .com and .net. In 2000, 2 years after its designation by the US government as the authority for overseeing internet naming policies, ICANN approved 7 new names, but only .info and .biz were truly for general use. Australians have delivered a stunning rebuke to telemarketers after more than 500,000 people signed up to the National Do Not Call Register in just 7 days. While a $33 million register does not come into effect until May the 31st, Australians have submitted a deluge of pre-registrations in order to block telemarketers from calling them at home for the next month. More than 530,000 people have pre-registered for the list, and as many as 400 people a minute were signing up during peak times. Senator Coonan said Australian consumers have voted with their feet and have given the Do Not Call Register the thumbs up. The initial overwhelming response to the opening pre-registrations, which resulted in more than 250,000 registrations in the first 24 hours, has settled down now. The senator went on to say that there is clearly a very high level of public interest in the register, and she urges consumers to register their number using the method that suits them best. At the moment, that can be either online or by post, with telephone registrations to be available in the near future. Talks between News Limited and Telstra executives last week failed to resolve a bitter dispute over the right to run online video news footage that has the National Rugby League caught in the middle. The fracas between the media company and the telco has led the NRL taking Telstra to court to try and force it to pay instalments on its $90 million sponsorship of the Premiership. This is the latest battle between news organisations, sporting codes and sponsors over the right to run online video footage under the fair use provisions that allow rival television stations to run each other's sporting footage. NRL executives have warned that a protracted dispute over the amount of NRL footage streamed on the Fox Sports internet site, which is operated by News Limited, could be hugely damaging to the code's revenue streams. And finally this week, the first person in the world to be convicted of distributing movies over the popular online BitTorrent network has appeared in Hong Kong's highest court to appeal his jail sentence. Chan Nai Ming, sentenced to 3 months in prison in 2005, sought to overturn a guilty verdict for distributing 3 Hollywood movies onto the web via the peer-to-peer file-sharing technology. A lawyer for the unemployed 38-year-old who used the screen name Big Crook said Chan only uploaded the movies without distributing them. Even if there was any act of distribution, it was done on part of the downloaders who initiated the process. BitTorrent allows downloads from multiple sources, each supplying a small part of the file, making it much easier and faster to share large files like films and software. And that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
Senator Coonan's sitting on the fence, to coin a cliche. In the middle of the podcast, you have a break about how to subscribe to the podcast featuring a child's voice. Apparently, it's been driving him and others absolutely crazy.
Paul Carl is Charlie.
It sounds like polarisation. It sounds like they've got two heads at right angles to each other.
When do you get time to do those sort of things?
I don't. That's a problem. I would have persevered a bit longer if I'd had the time.
Exactly. Yeah. I've always been a bit, we all have our feelings towards Phil.
I read the article and still couldn't quite picture what they were trying to do.
In this instance, you're shooting the messenger, aren't you? Let's talk about Telstra this week. Phil Burgess has been let out of his cage again.
This is the most important issue facing the future of this country.
You may be bandwidth impaired, living somewhere in rural Australia like Kilsyth.
Stop censoring us. We're going to post what we like on Dig, and we're going to vote for what we like on Dig.
Keep watching the Dig site, and so long as you don't get a 404, things are cruisy, hey?
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Showtime.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Here we are again. Welcome to Tech Talk Radio, everybody. Off to a bit of a creaky start this evening in the studio, but nonetheless, hopefully things will settle down. Dr. Ron, don't play with it and it won't go twang. How are you this evening?
I've been told that very well. The studio's on its last legs. We're going to be moving not before time, I suspect, in the next couple of months, aren't we?
Oh, it'll be lovely when we get going there. But nonetheless, we're here. We're all in one piece and things are chipping along. Graham, how's it going?
Not bad, Andrew.
Oh, look, I knew you'd do that to me. Try that.
It'll be going better if you turn my mic on. Thanks, Andrew.
It just summarises the day we've had so far. But anyway, we have a very special guest in this evening from the Wireless Institute of Australia, Robert Broomhead, and we're going to be talking about ham radio. There's a concept. It's a hobby.
Ham radio.
That's it. It's been very popular in the years, and then this thing called the internet came along. And what happened? We'll find out very shortly.
I'm looking forward to that. It'll be good.
But beforehand, I'm confused. I got home tonight, as you do, and found some spam in the mailbox from none other than the incumbent.
Snail mail spam.
Yeah, Telstra. Now, it's a document addressed to the business owner.
Right.
Trying to win over the virtues of come and join our company. We're pretty good and yada, yada, yada.
You're a Telstra customer already, though, aren't you? You've got some landlines at home.
Well, unfortunately, because, yes, exactly right. I am a Telstra customer. I haven't managed to break away from them completely yet. But nonetheless, here we go. I'd like to read from their sales brochure. Now, at any point in time, jump in and tell me you're confused, okay?
We need a buzzer.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
And get a prize. Broadband has become an essential tool for every business operator. Yeah, that's pretty good, huh? We can work that one out.
Yep.
The speed and convenience lets you go on with business while letting you get on with your life at the same time. Okay, now here comes the crunch. All the speed of Big Pond broadband from just $14.97 per month for the first 12 months. Oh, yeah. That's not bad.
That sounds pretty good, yeah.
See Note 1.
Oh, okay. What does Note 1 say?
Note 1 says, turn over to the back, down the very small fine print down the bottom, on the $29.95 broadband plan available to new Big Pond broadband ADSL customers who remain eligible. Minimum cost with business line complete and $20 mobile plan with 12 months half price access is $1,857.80.
There you go. So hang on a minute, hold the phone. So what you've got to have.
And I haven't even got the first line out.
You've got to have your mobiles with them as well.
Yes. Well, this is the plan. Yeah. This is what it says down the bottom. Okay. And by now you're going, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
What's going on here? Minimum cost with business line, and goes on, gives you more details without getting into too much details. But you turn back over the page, and the $14.97, which equates to the $29.95 one, it says here that you can't have the phone. It's not part of the bundle. I can't work that out.
That's quite odd. So they're automatically going to bump you up to the next plan, potentially. So,
I don't know, but so you're eligible. This is a confusing document. And that's what I said. When I opened it up tonight, I said, "Who's marketing department? Or am I just thick?"
And what's the speed?
Who's marketing department? Let you put this stuff out. And by goodness me, if you're a consumer,
is there any mention of the speed there that they're offering?
No.
On those plans?
Oh, yes, there is actually introducing Big Pond ADSL 2 Plus. So they're talking the high speed stuff.
Okay.
They're not mentioning the fact that they also meter you for uploads. No one else does, but
they're
they
one
do.
Of the very few ISPs in Australia that still do that.
And Telstra also cap the speeds on their ADSL 2, which doesn't always happen with other suppliers. So though it's ADSL 2, it might not be running at completely unfettered whatever proportion of 24 megabits per second you would otherwise get. It might be limited to, say, 8 megabits per second or something.
You've had first-hand experience with this, have you, or your customers have, Graham?
Well, I've read the brochures and decided to do something else. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think... Adam summed it up beautifully in an email that he sent last night, last show when we were on air, which I won't sort of say exactly word for word at the moment, but he inferred that people who went with the incumbent weren't really truly informed with current marketplace.
And that's really where...
trends, really.
That's what it comes down to, isn't it? They're relying on people being under-informed.
Well, I think they're still working on the loyalty vote. And speaking of such things, there was a bit of a rumour going around that the... you know, the guys that had a go at Qantas, the private equity investors that fell through?
Yeah.
You know, there's talk that they were going to have a go at Telstra.
Oh, dear. We had some relevant feedback as well about this.
Yeah. Telstra Chief Executive Sol Trujillo says that the telco has not received any takeover approaches. Asked by journalists if the company had received any approaches, he said simply no.
No.
I don't have time for that. Oh, okay. I wonder what he's doing.
Probably the clearest answer they've ever given.
It is.
We had some feedback from Craig via email. And if you've got an email to send us while we're on air...
I haven't read this one yet. I was a bit busy when it came in at work today.
That's right. We can have a quick look.
I have a printout here.
It's relevant to what you just have been telling us, Andrew. Send any emails you have through to onair@techtalkradio.com.au or feedback@techtalkradio.com.au. That's what Craig did. He says, further to last week's program, when Mark was talking about the Telstra handsets, sounded like he was a bit worried that it was a big advertisement for Telstra to an extent, but that wasn't our intention,
Mark,
Craig.
Never.
No, but we were, Mark was excited about the new technology that he had at his work. He wanted to balance up the new Telstra mobiles by looking at Three's market-leading X-Series mobile HSDPA broadband.
Oh, yeah.
He says its fixed network-like capped plans are way cheaper than Telstra Next G.
Well, that's exactly right. You can go to the Tech Talk Radio website and see the comparison on the very front page.
And Craig, we've done that for you. Andrew's gone to the effort of putting a table there so you can compare apples with apples on the Tech Talk Radio page.
But also buyer beware with the Three plans too. They're not as... read between the lines is what I'd say. From my reading between the line, you have to buy a normal plan to start with, a $29 plan, then you add on the $20 or $30 broadband X series.
So there's a baseline which you have to pay?
Yeah, there's a baseline, and then your X series stuff sort of kicks in for your data. It's not voice, it's data.
There's another big difference, of course, which is the coverage range of the two networks. You'll find that Telstra's Next G network will cover a much greater area of the country, whereas Three will really only work in good reception spots in the capital cities.
If you're talking about telephony, yeah, but you roam with Telstra when you get out of a city area. But if you're talking data, very expensive option.
Yes. Yeah, on data, it won't roam properly onto the other network because it just doesn't work.
No. Anything else in that letter there, Dr.?
Oh, that was all. Craig had some more details there, but send them, if you've got similar comments, send them through to us.
Craig, thanks for that. Also, Helen Coonan is a member. She's not a member for any electorate. She's the senator for New South Wales, born Wagga Wagga. There you go. I didn't know that. That's probably why I didn't know where her electorate was. I thought you had to have an electorate.
Senator. Not in the Senate. Senator represents states.
Well, there you go. That's why I stick to technology.
We've had some feedback from Imp this week.
Hello, Imp. Yes. Haven't heard from Imp for a while.
No, Imp's going well.
With regards, life in Queensland. He's in Queensland, isn't he?
I think so.
Far north.
With regards to the ABC online podcasts, we were talking about this saying that last week or the week before, saying that they were available to expats. He says they are only available in Australia. I just tried to get a friend in the UK to watch The Chasers War on Everything, and it said, "We're sorry, this video podcast is made available for use by persons located in Australia only. If you are not located in Australia, you are not authorised to use this podcast." I seem to recall you suggesting that expats could watch shows they missed from the ABC, just letting you know that they can't.
Well, they've had a case of the Pandoras, haven't they?
They have had a case of the Pandoras, yes. So thanks for the feedback.
There is proxy servers that you can use, and there are a lot of them springing up all around the place for this very reason. Where
it's certainly not for every ABC program either. It might be that some particular programs like The Chaser might be restricted, but a lot of the radio podcasts are not, and particularly the live streaming of the radio. The local radio here, you get people ringing in from all sorts of places all over the world listening to the stream.
Yes, that's very true, because I know that Lyd in the United States also listens to the ABC from time to time and surfs there. So,
so it depends on which particular resource you're after. Yeah.
Sorry, there's three conversations.
Sorry.
We did have a chat to Lyd. I rang her. I finally got through. She took my call.
Oh, very good.
And we had a chat. So she's coming up later on in the show too.
Excellent.
All right. Any other gossip for the time being, or should we get into the body of the program?
Let's get into it.
All right. Let's talk about Microsoft luring students to office. Now, if they didn't need any help, Microsoft have got the carrot out and they're dangling in front of students. Microsoft could expand its office on the cheap scheme for university students to include high school and even primary school students. The software giant has been running a pilot scheme where universities with Microsoft volume licensing deals have been offered their students a downloadable copy of the top version of the desktop application suite for $75. That's pretty good. Are they feeling competition from other areas, do you feel?
There is more and more pressure being put on Microsoft by movements like the Open Office.
OpenOffice.org.
Yes. What do you reckon, Graham?
Well, I've used OpenOffice.org. It's a fantastic program.
I've never used it, so I'm believing every word you're saying.
Suite of programs, yeah. It does
My notes are printed here with openoffice.org. And can I dispel a myth as well?
Oh, because you guys are Ubuntu's.
Yeah, but you do not have to be running a Linux-based system to use openoffice.org.
No, I've got openoffice.org installed on my Windows machine, and it runs really nicely. It does a great job.
What's in it? Same as you get in a normal Office suite, like a spreadsheet?
There's a word processor. There's a spreadsheet. It'll read the files that are generated by the Microsoft suite.
Yeah, so that was my question.
If you get sent a doc file, if you get sent an XLS file, it'll open them up.
Will they execute the same macro viruses that the Windows software will?
No, that's where it's stops.
Oh, good.
If it's got Visual Basic code or Visual Basic for Applications code or macro code in it that's Microsoft specific, then that code will not work.
Are there any idiosyncrasies at all with this operating system that won't work with traditional stuff?
Well, that would be the main one.
Yeah.
For most ordinary stuff, it works pretty well.
Well, that's a bargain. Where do you get it from?
Openoffice.org.
Okay, and it's just a download. Is it a big download?
It's relatively big. It's an Office suite, but it's manageable on a broadband connection quite easily.
How much does it cost, Graham? He asks knowingly.
Open source, that means not much at all.
That's right.
If you can download it for free.
Even less than that discounted Microsoft offering.
It costs basically the undertaking that if you modify it, you need to contribute your modifications back to the community.
Oh, very good. Well, there you go. That's what competition does, really, doesn't it? YouTube yields to royal pressure. YouTube is likely to remove all video clips deemed insulting to Thailand's king, a government official said last Thursday, because there's been this ruckus over there about someone putting something nasty about the king of Thailand up there. The popular video sharing site owned by internet giant Google has been blocked to Thai users since early April. Censorship. While showing the clips of that they'd showed clips of digitally altered images of the king. So it's a bit like, imagine if that happened here. I've seen mental images of John Howard being digitally altered and put up on YouTube. There'd be a people would flock to YouTube, wouldn't they?
How was the king digitally altered?
Doesn't say here.
I'd rather not know, to be honest.
Or stick to radio medium.
Coincidentally, Thailand have dropped their lawsuit against Google.
Maybe John Howard needs to be digitally altered too. Sorry. All right, moving right along. That went down really well. All right, MySpace eyes Photo Bucket. Have you guys used Photo Bucket before?
No, but I'm familiar with what it is.
We're going to talk about that later on in the show tonight. But Photo Bucket, in essence, is a place where we had a website of the week recently where you can go and get all this sort of stock art. And it's a place where people can upload images and share and download images to use on web pages, and it's all non-royalty based, so you don't pay any money or anything like that. You can use it in your presentations, on your websites, and all that sort of stuff. Fantastic services put up by people who are anywhere from pretty ordinary photographers through to pretty good photographers. You just take potluck and you search for things. But anyway, MySpace, Rupert Murdoch's trying to have a bit of action from that sort of sector at the moment too.
So is he putting an offer, Andrew, or is he just eyeing it off at the moment?
Oh, I think he's just keeping tabs on things, because Rupert was a bit late in the scheme of things getting on board some of the internet things, so he's got the checkbook out at the moment. So sort of like Google in a lot of respects. They're taking other... Well, maybe I shouldn't say that, but yes. Anyway, Warner Brothers, the movie house. This is going to be big news too. Warner's the first studio which is actually going to make their movies available for download online.
Without digital rights management.
Oh, yes. Sorry, I had a power glitch here then. Yes, without digital rights management. So you can actually go via a Hong Kong online shop called Video Online Communications, and they're going to start releasing films such as Superman Returns and Happy Feet and Harry Potter and all that sort of stuff for download. So you obviously pay to download it. But I suspect this is to curb the file sharing, which is currently going on at the moment. Because as the internet's getting faster and faster, it means that a movie can be downloaded and played locally at home, if you know the right place to get it, in a shorter time that takes you to go to the video library and actually get one these days.
No, that's very good.
And especially here in Australia, we're big on overseas. We're one of the biggest pirates in the world here because we like downloading. And let's think about it. The cause is not... It's the networks here, because they have no respect for viewers. They break, split and delay programs to such an extent that people just go, oh, I've had enough of this. I'm going to log on. I'm going to download and get it.
They do silly things, like in the middle of a new series of programs, they'll air a repeat or something odd like that, and it drives you crazy.
Or constantly change the night and time that a show is on. And
exactly, yeah, that's right, Graham. It drives you absolutely...
And you start off, you miss one episode, so you go and download that episode, and then you realise that, hang on, the rest of the series is here and we haven't seen any of it yet. I'll download all those as well.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's the thing, isn't it? And then they go to school and they get handed around and
yep.
go to uni and someone swaps it at work or the mother's group or even friends.
And then one night on TV, you'll see an ad for all new NCIS. And you think, no, that's not all new. I watched that
about last year. Yeah,
I saw that. That's right. I watched that about 9 or 10 months ago.
Mm.
Yes.
Yes. And the thing is, the reason why we do it is because, yes, they just don't want to keep us in the loop here in Australia. But anyway, hopefully they'll learn. The about 100 titles will be initially available. So, yeah, not going to be too shabby. I don't know whether they're going to go the back issue, but and I wonder if they're going to go something like on iTunes, load the client up and download it, or whether you just download an AVI file. Because DivX, which we mentioned earlier, is the codec, or the actual bit of software that enables us to do this. It can compress really good pictures into a very small space, and then when you reconstitute it at the other end in your DVD player, it looks pretty damn good. And so what would be 4.7 gig on a DVD comes down to, you know, quite nicely 700 meg, which is a CD quality size with very little image degradation. So, well, I can't pick it on some of the ones that I've seen. Any you guys?
Yeah, it certainly depends on how well it's been encoded, but all DivX and a whole range of the other encodings, including the Microsoft ones, they're all based on MPEG-4 underneath, so it does work out really well.
It's getting fairly clever out there.
The writing would be on the walls for the video libraries, surely?
Yes. Yeah, you wouldn't want to be investing into bricks and mortar, I think, based on that, would you?
Well, I don't remember the last time I went to one, do you?
Neither do I. No, we've got this used to have this huge industry in Australia, video libraries. You'd pop down the road and grab yourself a couple of DVDs, $3 for, three weeklies or something like that. But
well, when you think about it with your broadband, and let's face it, your average broadband starter should be around 3 gig or 5 gig of download. Even you look at that, it's 700 meg for a movie. That's not much, but like I know my bandwidth is I've got about a 15 or a 16 meg limit each month, and that enables me to do things like that when the time is right and easily download, put on the CD. The kids love it.
I've just gone from 8 gig to 14 gig, I think.
Have you?
For about the same price.
Oh yeah, no, it's you're mad not to take these telcos up on their offer. And if there's just so much more you can do out there on the internet nowadays than just email and web browse, so absolutely. Get into it.
Yep.
Don't be afraid. Use the force, Luke. Telcos are holding us back. Did you know that? In a report out by the Switzerland organised...
Graham appears surprised.
Yeah.
Sorry, was that news to you, was it?
No.
Okay, well, allegedly...
I'm surprised that this is news.
You're not surprised. Well, this actually isn't allegedly. This is fact. A report released by the World Competitiveness Scoreboard for 2007, released in Switzerland last week, says Australia needs better foundations for economic growth in an increasingly competitive world. Apart from education, of which John Howard's getting into at the moment, they pointed the finger at the use of technology and the technology available within the country. So this is one of the outside countries looking in at Australia and having a bit of a look and seeing what's going on. Now, that doesn't surprise you guys?
They think we're being held back? We're falling behind the rest of the world?
Yeah.
Well, no, this is not a surprise at all. It's a sad indictment on the state of broadband in Australia as a very fundamental part of that problem, I think.
Yeah. Senator Coonan's office made a big song and dance. I got a press release today. I think you guys might have seen it too.
Did you get the impression she was in Adelaide today?
She was in Adelaide and she was making an announcement. I printed it out somewhere, but I thought, oh, is that it?
She made it, exactly.
Some $2.3 million. I haven't got it. It'll be buried here somewhere.
We got all the usual... The Coonan spam has just ramped up at a million rate of knots in the last
couple of weeks. There must be an election coming.
Yes. Who would have thunk it? Yes, I've got one of the releases here, Andrew. Launch of telephone registrations in South Australia for the new Do Not Call register.
So, the half-hearted do not call register.
Well, that's the one. Why she's singling out South Australians is everyone is able to register now, but she just wanted to ramp it up and...
Well, that's where the call centre is, isn't it? Maybe I misread that. Is that where the call centre is?
I just got the impression that she was preaching to South Australians, but she said that their telephone registrations are now available, as well as web.
For South Australians.
You have?
Yeah,
you have.
ABC in South Australia.
That's right. You're a bit of radio in South Australia, don't you? So, that was all the media release said. But there were all these emails coming out of her office saying, stand by for another email about to
appear. She normally never does that, so I thought, oh, here we go. They've made a decision on broadband in this country, but no.
No, it was just rehashing an announcement made the previous week.
Yes. We've got 6 months of this to go, haven't we? And then what?
Yes.
The other thing, too, there was a bit of a faux pas this week. I don't know whether you caught on with what happened on Telstra's Now We're Not Talking website.
Oh, yes, one of those socially awkward moments.
Yes, it was. It was. Adam Turner just captured the moment absolutely brilliantly. So let's have a little view from the couch.
Adam Turner's View from the Couch on Tech Talk Radio.
Telstra's war of words with the government and the competition watchdog is going into overdrive as the federal election draws closer and pressure builds on the federal government to break the deadlock that is stopping the rollout of a national high-speed fibre network. Along with encouraging customers and shareholders to lobby the government and regulators to give in to its demands, Telstra also runs a thinly veiled propaganda website called Now We Are Talking. The site likes to compare Telstra's competitors to leeches, even adding pictures of the little suckers to make their point. Now We Are Talking also likes to highlight the foreign ownership of Telstra's competitors such as Optus, but it conveniently overlooks the fact that Telstra is the foreign-owned competitor in other countries such as New Zealand. Anyway, Now We Are Talking likes to run online polls, asking loaded questions such as, do you support Telstra taking legal action to protect its shareholders' constitutional rights? And should foreign companies be eligible for taxpayer dollars to build networks to compete with Telstra in Australia? Not surprisingly, the results of these polls are skewed in Telstra's favour, and Now We're Talking uses them as proof that Australia supports its campaign to build a fibre-to-the-node network on its own terms. But a funny thing happened last week. One of Now We're Talking's polls backfired on it, and badly. The site asks its readers, who do you think is blocking high-speed broadband for Australia? They could choose from the government, the regulator, Telstra's competitors, Telstra itself, or I don't know. A whopping 97.1% of respondents said Telstra is to blame. Whoops, not exactly the result Now We're Squawking was hoping for. Not surprisingly, the site pulled down the poll and claimed it was rigged. Funnily enough, they didn't complain when previous poll results were so skewed, such as 94.6% of people believing Jamie Packer was right in urging the government to back Telstra's broadband investment plans. Now, to be fair to Telstra, it would appear that the poll was rigged, considering it had 13,000 votes, and most of the site's other polls struggled to get 1,000 votes. Now We're Talking has attempted to take the high moral ground, claiming it was a hot enough issue for someone to spam the poll rather than, quote, leave it up to democracy. Talk of democracy is pretty rich coming from Telstra, especially considering it's been busted rigging online polls in the past. In 2002, a Telstra contractor was dismissed after admitting he rigged the results of an online survey run by ZDNet, asking readers whether Telstra's Big Pond internet service provided value for money. No one in their right mind could say yes to that. Unfortunately, Telstra's competitors can't claim the high moral ground here either. It's clear that the Now We're Talking poll was rigged against Telstra, but it didn't stop T4, a coalition of Telstra's competitors, issuing a press release saying the result indicates the public may finally be hearing the truth about what is holding back high-speed broadband in Australia. So, the propaganda is coming thick and fast from both sides now. Never let the facts get in the way of a good story.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1300 664 882 and leave a voice message. That's 1300 664 882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. You're listening to Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan, and welcome to our very special guest this evening, Robert Broomhead, who's the Director of the Wireless Institute of Australia. Thank you for coming in this evening, Robert.
Thanks for that, Andrew.
Just to start off, the Wireless Institute of Australia is the world's finest and oldest national radio society, being founded in 1910. The Wireless Institute of Australia is a member of the International Amateur Radio Union and represents all amateur radio operators in Australia to the various government bodies in this country. That's what your website says, and I reckon that sums it up pretty much.
That's right. That's what we do.
All right. 1910, that was a long time ago. I wasn't around then. I guess you weren't either. So
we're having centenary celebrations fairly
100
soon.
100 years, yeah.
That's great. Yeah, they're coming up.
What, are you going to mark it in some manner or form?
Yeah, we're going to have some special events on that centenary year. Usually we have things like special call signs that are can be used by the radio amateurs to mark a special event. So I imagine that there'll be some rather good things happening in that aspect, special call signs and things like that, but we can talk about call signs later, I guess.
We can. Tell me about the history of amateur radio and the Wireless Institute, really going back in that era. Like, today it's a fairly sizable organisation, it's a national organisation, but back then, how did it start?
Well, the early radio amateurs, radio experimenters, I guess we take it right back to the early days of radio, when radio broadcasting first started, and there were always people who were interested in experimenting with electronics, experimenting with radio, and actually building their own radio transmitters. And way back then, they would apply to the government regulator, as it was then. And
Who were they? We had this discussion on the show recently. I don't know whether you were listening or not. We tried to work out it was Telecom and
was it the Postmaster General,
and it sort of there were all these derivatives back then. It must have been the PMG.
Yeah, PMG, I believe. Way back then, and they used to be able to obtain a experimenter's license and. With that experimenter's license, they used to be able to build equipment and experiment broadcasting. And the interesting thing is, back then, they were allowed to broadcast music and radio programs.
So do what we're doing now.
Pretty much what we're doing now, yeah.
Can I let you in on a secret? There's 4 licensed radio amateurs in this room right now.
Crikey.
Yeah, we've let that out of the bag, haven't we? And here we are broadcasting music and entertainment and things like that. With maybe just
the irony. The irony.
Oh, yes, that's right. Amazing, isn't it?
So radio amateurs can't broadcast music now, Robert?
No. The licenses I talked about before, way back then, we're only talking about a handful of experimenters around Australia. These days, there's about 14,000 radio amateurs around Australia, and so obviously that's grown from the small handful it was back in the early days.
I must admit, one of the things that appealed to me about the hobby was the experimentation side of things, to actually get your hands dirty, get out there and build things that you couldn't buy in a shop and experiment and have fun with friends, I think. That was one of the things which I thought was the key to getting involved in the hobby. Has that changed much?
It's moved with the times. Certainly the level of experimentation, the type of experimentation has changed. These days we don't play around with, most of us don't play around with valves and things like that, but there's been a lot of...
They bite indeed.
But the latest buzz that everybody's starting to play with is something called SDR, or software-defined radios, and that's where you're combining computer software to actually define what the radio is, and to control the radio. There's been some smart computer ICs that have been and radio ICs that have been developed to enable people to experiment with electronics, computers and radio all together and build their own radios in software.
Well, that's a good thing, really. It mixes all the technologies together in a lot of respects, doesn't it? So you can program, build, implement and get involved.
Yeah, that's
really
right. Yeah,
it certainly highlights the diversity of the hobby. I know a lot of people have this stereotypical image in their head of someone sitting in front of a microphone talking to somebody on the other side of the world in a distant, crackly, almost science fiction-sounding tones on the radio.
Yes, white lab coats and basements and stuff like that, yeah.
And that's not the case these days, is it?
Not really, no. You get people operating from the comfort of their own homes, from their spare room in their home, or maybe their four-wheel drive out and, they're camping and stuff like that.
Well, exactly. One of the interesting talks I went to recently when I was doing some research for the show was one of the local radio clubs had a talk on a gentleman who uses amateur radio operators to help track wildlife through the forest in the preservation and monitoring of, I guess, climate change and those sort of things, make sure the little critters are living and breeding and doing what they're supposed to be doing. And you know, that's part of how the community can help out, really, isn't it?
That's right. That's that tracking of using radio transmitters to attach to, say, a bird and actually tracking them to see where their habitat resides and where their flight patterns are, etc. That's called radio tracking or radio direction finding, and that's probably one of the more popular aspects of amateur radio. As radio amateurs, people get out there and do the same thing.
You were sort of saying before you can marry computers and things like that to radio communications. Well, this is marrying four-wheel drives, the bush, and a bit of technology together. So if you like, and GPS navigation, because that's involved in a lot of these games that we all play these days. So
that's right.
If you like reading a map on a one of your Palm Pilots, then this could be a good option.
Yeah, there's groups of people right around Australia that get together once a month and get out there with a hidden radio transmitter and then go chasing it in their cars and on foot.
Yes, and they call it sport. Yes. All right, so of recent times, the internet has sort of come along and a lot of, I guess, youth, which would have been the up-and-coming ranks into the fraternity, have probably turned their attentions to, you know, this SMS things and phones and internets and personal IRC, all that sort of stuff. Is that been a factor in amateur radio and the growth of the hobby of recent times?
Oh, I believe it has, yeah. And certainly within a number of radio groups that I'm involved with and speak to, etc., a lot of the club members, for example, would go and play with computers. In fact, a lot of radio clubs declined in numbers since the 70s when computers started to become prevalent. However, over recent years, there's been an increase in membership, an increase in numbers, and that's people who have previously been involved with radio who may still have what's called an amateur radio transmitting license. They still have one of those. They get back into the hobby again. Perhaps they've become a little jaded with the computer thing. They use computers at home, then use computers at work. They're looking for something a little different to do. Pull out the old amateur radio license, dust off the radios, and get back on the air again. And radio clubs that have seen had small numbers of people have grown to hundreds and hundreds of members again.
I remember when...
Thanks, Andrew. I remember when I was coming through school and becoming interested in amateur radio that one of the things people were experimenting with back then was what was called packet radio, which was sending data over radio networks. And
that was the early form of data communications, really, yeah. Wasn't it? Analog.
Yep, and they were getting very good at sending increasingly high-speed data over radio links.
It was radio teletype before that, wasn't it?
Yep, and I had radio teletype running at my house on a little computer in the late 80s, or mid-80s, and it's that technology that's come forward and gone into the mainstream that the telecommunications companies are now using to do things like MMS messaging and data over mobile phone networks. It's all related. It goes back to that same stuff that we were experimenting with back then, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. And the stuff that you were experimenting with back then continues today, but it's been enhanced even further. People are now using it mobile in their cars with GPSs and tracking their vehicle locations and watching each other drive around. Yep.
And that technology will feed back into the mainstream as well. So there's that experimentation is very real and very you know, has very real world applications.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is it a costly sort of hobby to get into?
No, not really. To buy your first amateur radio set, well, you could buy something that's a converted old taxi radio for about $50.
You're not going to rule out people based on, you know, income. Anyone can do it. You can always find something somewhere to get you involved once you've got the license.
Absolutely not.
And although you don't build your own set from a pile of valves anymore, there's your local radio club will help you modify that taxi radio or whatever it happens to be, and it becomes that experimenter's delight to get something working like
that's
that.
That's right.
Well, that means radio clubs are playing a major part. How many radio clubs are there in Australia, would you say, Robert?
Oh, there's about 120, I believe.
So there's got to be one close to you somewhere out there.
Yeah, within the Melbourne suburbs, there's, I can think of about 12 that I know of around Victoria.
All right. And what about regional areas and regional parts of the country? We've got a lot of population in the southern part, so we probably have a lot of radio clubs. But what about up north?
Oh, yeah. Well, right around in the regional areas, if I perhaps give you some examples, I know that Ballarat, Bendigo, Geelong's got two. Cobram, Shepparton, all of those regional areas all have a radio club of one form or another.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Australia-wide, how would someone go about finding their local radio club?
If they go to the Wireless Institute of Australia website. There's a section on there which entitled clubs, and that'll give you an idea of where to find your local radio club.
And we'll make sure that address is given out again later on in the program.
And we'll put it up on our website too, so people can come and have a visit there as well. The science behind the hobby. One of the other fascinating things which I thought was, well, got me intrigued, is things like solar radiation and ionizations of certain levels in the atmosphere, which made radio signals behave in certain manners. I learnt a lot back then, and I guess that still applies to communications today. Not so much because we rely on it, but it's a bit of fun to play with the changing conditions. Where are we in the sunspot cycle these days? It must be global warming and all. Got lots of sun. Yeah,
we're just coming out of what's called the bottom of the sunspot cycle at the moment.
What does that mean?
Well, bottom of the sunspot cycle means that it's not very good for what's called HF or shortwave amateur radio communications at the moment. But the good news is, over the coming years, it's going to get much, much better.
11 or 12-year cycle or something, isn't it?
That's right, that's right.
So now's a great time to get into it if you want it, because things only get better as you get...
And the word is that this sunspot cycle is going to be an absolute ripper. It's going to be better than...
Yeah, no rain, right?
That's right.
Robert, all this technical stuff that you're talking about, all this mumbo-jumbo and sunspots and ionospheric things and tropospheric stuff and atmosphere and all that good business... I don't know about any of this stuff. How do I learn about it? And do I need to have a level of knowledge before I apply for a license?
Well, this is a very good question. And this is, if I can just explain something that's happened over the last couple of years. As I mentioned before, I'm involved with the Wireless Institute of Australia as one of the directors. The Wireless Institute of Australia, negotiated with the Australian Communications and Media Authority, and... after much consultation and negotiation, we're pleased to announce, or the ACMA was pleased to announce, a new license. We were able to restructure the amateur radio licenses, and there was a new license came out called Foundation License.
Okay.
Now, with Foundation License, you can obtain your Foundation License over a weekend by attending a simple one-day training course.
Is that held by like the recognised radio clubs?
Absolutely. All the recognised radio clubs are pretty much... running these training courses. Typically, it'll be run over a weekend. On the Saturday, there may be some training, and on the Sunday, they have what's called assessments. Now, with this new radio license, the good news for listeners is that it doesn't require Morse code. One of the things that happened years ago was a dropping of Morse code as a requirement to be able to operate an amateur radio station, and a lot of people saw that as being a real roadblock for them to have to learn Morse code to be able to get up on the air and play amateur radio. So the good news is no more Morse code. It's still used on air, and there's still a lot of people passionate about it, but you don't require it to get your radio license.
You don't have to not use it on a double negative or anything like that, but it's just that's part of the romantic days when ships were at sea and all that sort of stuff. Right. So,
and there were people who still play with it.
They were still enthusiastic.
Yeah. So this Foundation license, we've had it since October. We've had it, let me just quick look at my notes here. October 2005, it was first launched, and by October 2006, we had 1,000 new radio amateurs.
So the population grew pretty sharply just because of this new introductory license.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We've been able to turn what was a hobby which was declining in numbers to now a hobby which is actually growing in numbers. And we've got more radio amateurs on the air now than we had 5 or 6 years ago. And that's pretty exciting.
That's tremendous.
And is that any credit go to the governing body, the ACMA, for that, to allow people to do that? Because don't we have to abide by international laws, the ITU and things like that? They set the rules of minimum requirements?
They set the rules for internationally recognised requirements. So, and also for things like harmonisation of frequencies that are being used
globally, in
various countries around the world, just so that we don't have an amateur radio license here that broadcasts on some aircraft band, perhaps in another country. We all use the same frequency.
Oh, heaven forbid. That'd be tragic, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break, and when we return, we'll talk a little bit more about Robert. We'll touch base on the Foundation license and how you go about getting one, where to start, how complex it really is, and where you can get a syllabus and all that. And I think that's going to start at the radio club, but that'll be in just a moment.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Subscribing to the Tech Talk Radio podcast is so easy. It's child's play.
Podcasting's so easy, even my little brother can do it.
Step one, visit the iTunes Music Store and search for Tech Talk Radio in the podcast section. Step two, click subscribe and you're done. Now every week you'll be able to listen to Tech Talk Radio whenever, wherever and however you like. You could be mowing the lawn, on a train, in a car, on a plane, at work,
visiting the relatives, washing the car. Pressing.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're joined tonight by one of the directors of the Wireless Institute of Australia, Robert Broomhead, who's in to tell us all about amateur radio, the hobby, if you want to become involved, how easy it is to do it. And by goodness me, it's become considerably easier these days than it used to be back in the good old days. Technology's made it so. You know, we didn't have to learn about Morse code. We now no longer need to know about valves, I think, either, in the syllabus. All those sort of things have been left to history. And we just talk about the things which are current and relevant. Let's talk about the qualifications, Robert. Tell me about the actual, what do you need to know about the foundation license and the other license? Tell us about all license categories, but primarily the foundation license.
Okay. As I said before, we went to the ACMA and with their help them in restructure the licenses, or the ACMA restructured the licenses, I guess, with consultation with ourselves. The licenses have now been restructured to three pretty straightforward grades of license. There's something called Foundation, which I spoke about before, and that's the new entry-level license. That's brand new. There's something called Standard, which is, for any of the people who know anything about amateur radio, if you've heard of the old Novice license, that's what Standard is now called. It's just a standard grade license. And there's an Advanced Grade license, which is the highest level of amateur radio license you can get. And the difference between them is the different radio bands that you're allowed to transmit on and the amount of power that you're allowed to transmit with.
Okay. So in essence, you can really just get up on air with the foundation license, and that'd pretty well cover a lot of local issues anyway, just talking locally and even internationally too with a ticket like that, wouldn't it?
That's right. That's right.
Robert, if I want to move from the foundation license to standard or then standard to advanced, do I have to do more exams, or how does that work?
That's right. That's right. The radio clubs and other groups will run training, further training courses. There's also a very good online radio course for doing standard and advanced upgrades from a site called radioelectronicschool.net, www.radioelectronicschool.net, or one word. Ron runs that site and he provides online computer-based training material for those that wish to upgrade. So that's another method of upgrading. So we have foundation, standard and advanced. One of the things about the foundation license is it's been structured as effectively as an operating license. So we're teaching people how to operate an amateur radio and what they need to be able to do that safely and without causing harmful interference to...
And that's the key to it, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
You don't want to interfere with your local neighbour's telly or essential services or like that. So, now, the licence is like a motor car licence in a lot of respects. You apply once you successfully pass the exam, and you're issued an annual licence, which you have to pay annually. What sort of costs involved in that?
It's about...
$50 or something.
$58.
Yeah. So it's nothing huge.
It's not huge.
And you get a certificate or a license from the government that
That's
says
right.
you're entitled to do what you're supposed to do.
That's right.
Hang it up on the wall and you'll be proud of it.
Yeah, you get two things. You get a frame certificate saying that you've passed your foundation license. You can stick that on the wall. It's got a picture of yourself on it and just put it in a nice frame.
Wow.
And you also get your transmitting license.
Mine. Yeah. When I got mine, I was back in secondary school, and it was pretty ugly, let me tell you.
Yeah. And you also get a license as well from the ACMA, yeah. Robert.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
The ACMA is the Australian Communications and Media Authority. Is that right? And
that's
they're the federal organisation that regulates licensing.
That's correct.
All right. So let's talk about complexity. Okay, we've whetted someone's appetite out there and they've sort of said, yeah, I'll give this a go because it's only a weekend of my time. And with having spent a good weekend doing this, what sort of cost is involved in that weekend and what do they come out with at the other end?
Well, the cost of the weekend, I guess, is really a little bit up to the radio club running the training. Most radio clubs will be offering training at absolutely minimal cost, or just for club membership.
So to cover the hall hire and the bickies and
tournaments. That's right. The radio clubs are doing it because they are passionate about the hobby and they want to help other people get into the hobby. So they're not making it prohibitively expensive.
So I'm looking at $60, let's call it, license each year. I'm looking at maybe $10, maybe plus or minus for tea and bickies. What about study guides and books and things like that?
Okay. The book itself, we've produced, the Wireless Institute of Australia have produced a book called the Foundation License Manual. It's called Your Entry into Amateur Radio, the Foundation License Manual. That's available. It's got a retail price of about $18. You'll find that some radio clubs will even offer that a little bit cheaper.
It's a lovely glossy brochure here that we did, because you've actually bought a few in tonight. They look terrific. And
Everything you need to know is in that book.
So you sit down there and take it to bed with you at night and read the books and learn all about it.
It's not exactly an encyclopedia volume, isn't it? Is it? It's a manageable size.
It's an exceptionally,
it's very clearly laid out.
Exactly. It's not what you call lots of small print. It's quite easy to read for those who are not that way inclined. So, and it seems to be very good pictures, good examples. The odd ad in there. So,
As you were saying before. It's a bit like a motor car license. You use that licensing when you talked about getting a motor car license. In a lot of ways, the foundation license is, in a lot of ways, like teaching somebody how to drive a motor car, because part of the training is training you how to operate the radio, where you're allowed to go, what you're allowed to do. And then part of the assessment or the examination process is to actually set up a radio and give you a bit of on-air experience and actually have the person drive a radio and make sure that they're okay with doing that.
Okay, so that was going to be my next question. How does the exam work? Is it a multiple choice? Do you have to bring your calculator and slide rule, or how does it work?
Not at all. Not at all. It's a 25-question multi-choice exam paper that you sit.
Mm-hmm.
Multi-choice, with the obvious answer will be there if you're familiar with it. And so that's quite easy to complete. And then there is a further, what we call the practical assessment, where Joe just described, where we actually sit you down with a little bit of radio gear and watch you set it up, have a couple of on-air contacts just to make sure that you know the procedures of operating on air. And if you're successful with that, and most people are, then you're right to go and obtain an amateur radio license.
Okay, so I've walked away from the weekend. I'm excited. I've got the big tick. How long does it take to get the certificate to go and get my own radio or be on air? What do I do? Because I'm all excited and G'd up and ready to go.
Well, then the news gets better too, because back in the old days, that used to take months of waiting. Now you can pretty much, within 2 weeks, 3 weeks, if the ACMA is a bit busy, you'll hear back from the ACMA and with a notification of your call sign, or you can check online via the ACMA website and keep an eye on the call sign register, and you'll see when your name pops up.
Okay. So you'll be told on the day that congratulations, you've passed. Now just wait for the protocol to take its place.
That's right.
Do all that.
So the whole assessment process has changed now that we're using registered and trained assessors within the radio clubs, and they're able to mark the exam papers, tell you the result. You can fill out your license application form there and then on the spot, send it all off with the money, and it's simply a matter of checking the ACMA website and seeing when your license numbers have come up.
Fantastic. All right. We have, thanks to the Wireless Institute of Australia, 5 copies of your entry into amateur radio book, what Robert's just been talking about. Now we're going to give them away to 5 listeners. So if you want to give us a call on our feedback line on 1-300-664-882 and leave a message, what we're going to do, we're going to give 2 copies to people within our radio service areas and 3 copies to the first callers through who might be listening to us outside of our radio service area. I think that's probably a fair way to go.
If you have trouble with the 1-300 number for some reason, try 03-90-12-5362. That'll go through to the same message box.
So thanks to the Wireless Institute of Australia for contributing a couple of books tonight, and hopefully that'll spawn on at least another 5 members to the amateur radio fraternity. Now, let's move on, and we'll talk about that and put the information up on our website, but let's talk a little bit about IRLP. You've got a real-world example here about what you can actually do with amateur radio, haven't you, Rob?
That's right. We talked before about HF radio, the shortwave radio, being able to talk around the world. One of the things that radio amateurs as experimenters have been able to do is link radio communications with the benefits of the internet. So combining voice over IP, which...
had to happen, didn't it?
Yeah. So we're integrating the radio networks and the internet.
That's right.
That's terrific.
And what does IRLP stand for?
Internet Radio Linking Project, IRLP.
Linking Project. Okay, so what can we do?
So I can be driving to and from my work location and talking on a what's called a VHF or a UHF radio in my car and talking to someone else around the world. And very quickly, the way that it works is that my car is talking to a radio base somewhere here locally in Melbourne, which is hooked to the internet. Voice over IP then goes around the world to another corresponding station where you've got radio base and someone else driving to their work in their car, maybe in Europe or in the UK.
That's great. No phone network, no Wi-Fi.
What about time delay? That's, to me, like, we all know VoIP sort of, you know, can be a little bit delayed, but what about all the processing? Is it pretty quick?
It's pretty quick, yeah. It's pretty quick. I've got a little handheld with me here.
Now there's a little device, which is, you know, maybe a couple hundred bucks from the local shop.
Cost me about $2.95. That one's a brand name one. You can get the cheap ones for $99.
Okay. Here we go. Live radio, everybody.
Turn it on here. Now, if I push in... let me get the
secret code.
Our guest is consulting his list of secret codes now.
I'll use one I know here. So by simply pushing the transmit button and then dialing in on the touch keypad here, which is a bit like a telephone keypad, the number of the station that I want to connect to. I'll just do one now.
So this looks like a phone, like a handheld phone.
Here we go. We're connecting.
Oh,
it's around the world.
To note 8000, SK6B repeater, located in southwest Sweden, link on.
Okay, now if I continue now to push the talk button here on this handheld, I'll be talking to people in Sweden.
Cool. That's what about Denmark? Can we go to Denmark? We can check out the Royals.
Absolutely.
So if there are other people driving in their cars, Robert, and they're just cruising around town...
Tom is in Sweden. Yeah, they'd be close to GMT.
Hear you coming out their radios.
Absolutely.
So that's pretty impressive when you think about it. You've got a very small transmitter, very small indeed, and you can use that to talk to someone on the other side of the world or down the street for the cost of nothing.
But I was just going to say, Andrew, for the cost of nothing, I was going to say to Robert, but surely every time you push that... press the talk button or something, it's going to cost you 20 cents or a dollar, or you have to be on some sort of plan like you are with a mobile phone, surely?
No, it doesn't cost anything. It just costs you a yearly license fee and the $25 you probably paid to do your foundation license in the first place. So.
And that's because the people running the equipment at both ends are radio amateurs and they're enthusiasts who are doing it for the benefit of everybody else. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
One of the other things of amateur radio, which there's contests and things like that, and there's awards associated with contests. Can you tell us a little bit about what happens? Because there's a few, Memorial Day competitions, isn't there?
That's right. People sometimes get the bug for entering into contests. In fact, lots of people get into the bug of entering into contests. And that's basically where you have a designated weekend or a designated number of hours. And you absolutely go for it and try to make contact with as many other radio amateurs within a certain area as possible within a given time.
It's a great camping weekend away normally. You go and hibernate on top of a hill and take the jenny and fill the fridge and do all those sort of things and take some good company. And I know we've all been guilty of that in this room and had some really good memorable times doing it.
Just last weekend there was a contest on the shortwave radio bands between Australia and New Zealand. So there were a lot of New Zealand radio amateurs and Australian amateurs trying to make as many contacts with each other as possible within the given time period.
A lot of fun. Just before we wrap up, I've just got a couple more questions. One would be, how is amateur radio in this country faring against amateur radio in other countries? Are we still progressively growing the ranks as like other countries are? My guess is that we are with this foundation license. And where do you see the future of amateur radio in the next few years going? We've seemed to overcome the hurdle of the internet.
One of the first countries overseas to introduce the foundation license was the UK. So over in England, they actually had a head start on us and they released their foundation license, I think it was about a year before we did. So they certainly set a great, they set off with a great pace, and also have thousands of new radiometers up on the air. We've got our foundation license. We're growing our numbers here in Australia, and we're certainly seeing growth in other countries too. Japan, amateur radio is absolutely huge in Japan.
Ah,
and,
yes.
And in the United States as well.
All right. That's terrific. Robert, thank you very much for coming in tonight, and thank you very much for leaving us a couple of books for our listeners too. So once again, if you missed it, if you want to get your foundation license, we have the book here. You need to go no further, not even to a website, except for ours maybe. What you have to do is ring us on 1300 664 882, or Dr. Ron?
03-9012-5362.
And if you're in our radio service area, we've got two books to give away to the first two callers. And if you're listening to us on the pod from further afield, not in one of our radio service areas, then there's three up for grabs. So yeah, partake. Come and get one of these fantastic books.
Just leave your contact details in the message and where we can get onto you, maybe an email address. And
yeah, we might give you a ring and have a chat to you on air and find out what your plans are.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good.
Yeah. And Robert, I'll also give you some web addresses for some of the radio clubs that are in the local service area here of this station too, so any local listeners, they can get them off your TikTok radio website.
Yeah, we do that, and naturally visit the Wireless Institute of Australia, because you've got many divisions in many states.
Well, that's the way it used to be.
Oh, boy, am I that behind the eight ball. Did you know that, Dr. Ron?
No, I thought we're in Victoria Division here. Am I showing my age, am I?
No, that's okay. A couple of years ago, we figured a better way of doing things, and we now have one National Wireless Institute of Australia that looks after all of Australia.
So you stick with us, you learn things, boys.
Yeah, you certainly do.
All right, fantastic. Thank you, Robert, for coming in. We'll have to do it again sometime shortly. I've actually become a bit more inspired because I haven't been very active at all recently.
Oh, thanks.
So, all right, we're going to take a break now. In the meanwhile, we're going to have a little chat to Lydia Davis. Do you guys remember Lydia?
Vaguely.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she did a bit of a... They had a Google thing on, as you do.
She had a picnic.
She did. She got invited to G'day Google, which is in the lands of Google Land in Palo Alto. Well, actually, where is it? Mountain View. She's in Palo Alto. The next suburb along is Mountain View, where it all happens for Google. And... yes, we found out a bit about what's going on in Google. Well, welcome back to Lydia Davis to Tech Talk Radio, our correspondent in Palo Alto. It's been a long time no speak. What have you been doing?
It has been a long time. I've been doing lots here. So hello, everyone in Australia. We've been doing lots. We've been visiting all the local tech places. We've had a chat to Google. We're actually having a chat to WordPress next week.
So you went along to Google's G'day Google. Tell us about G'day Google. What was that
G'day
all about?
G'day Google was, they had a function here. I think they had a function in Australia. I think they had functions everywhere. They were talking to developers, trying to get them interested in working for Google, obviously. And I thought it was
Wouldn't be too hard, I wouldn't have thought, an organisation like that.
Yeah, but I mean, there's specific things that you need to know before you can work for Google. They don't just take everyone you see. So they need you need to have specific talents and specific ways of working, and that's what they're looking for. They're looking for people that have the qualifications, that have the knowledge, and have the, I suppose, interest in working a lot of hours to get a really good product out.
Why Australians? I assume that's the flavour of the G'day Google day.
Yeah, Australia is one of Google's top performing countries. And in terms of online advertising, I don't know whether you know, but I mean, in terms of how much advertising people spend, it's like over $1 billion and growing. In Australia, it's about 23% and growing, and, you know, I suppose they want people in there helping them grow.
So, once again, why does that reflect on Australia? Are they trying to drum up business here, or is it a good market for them already?
Okay, well, they've got about 100 people working in Australia at the moment. I think they hit 100 in 2006, and they've been growing very slowly in Australia, and now I think the big push is happening where they just need people because they're doing a lot of really exciting stuff, particularly maps. I don't know how well acquainted you are with Google Maps.
I think everyone's used them at one point or another, and they're certainly becoming very popular for overlays for people's websites when they're trying to find an organisation, company or a location.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, because there's so much information now. What they were saying, Alan Noble was giving a speech throughout this night, and he's the engineering director for Google Australia.
Okay.
So he manages, the growth of Australian R&D and engineering. So he wants to hire people. But he was basically saying that about 70% of queries are in some way geographically related. So that, you know, you might be searching for a hotel where you want to go, or to a winery, whatever it is that you're searching for. You know, traffic information. What's the highway? What's Highway 101 like? So he looks at the fact that 70% of queries are basically geographical in some way, and he says, okay, well, we need to work on Google Maps, and they're doing some amazing stuff with Maps, and you can search for it pretty much anything, and it will just give it to you. You will find businesses, you will find anything you want. You know, you can use it pretty much for anything rather than go back to Google's main page. You can use Google Maps. So I don't know how it works in Australia. I mean, here, there's no need for us to have any sort of malware, you know. You guys will know what I'm talking about, but I mean, I remember when we first got him, we asked someone to give us a street directory, and everyone said, what? You know, what do you need that for? And no one uses them here because Google Maps just does everything for you. You know, it'll tell you exactly how long it takes to to get to somewhere. Yeah, there's been stuff up.
So what, everyone has a PDA in their car, really, for that to work, obviously?
Well, I don't know whether everyone does.
How do you do it?
I just before I leave, I just print up. Usually you'll find people with invitations, like we've got Jamie's birthday coming up, and one of the things we've done on the back of the invitation is we've just printed out, you know, these are the directions based on Google Maps, you know, and there you go. And we've also linked it. She's got a little blog happening telling people what she likes, what she doesn't like. So she's also linked it off that, where people can go to Google Maps and see exactly where this place is where we're having a party. So, you know, it's just used so often and so much that people don't, there's no need for street directory. So, you know, malware, you've got to start thinking differently.
Well, I guess we're all creatures of habit, but I guess there'd be a lot of people who aren't that sort of internet savvy that aren't that way inclined, which would probably still prefer the odd paper malware or street directory, I guess. So Google obviously must have some fairly big aspirations. What's the future looking like for them?
Well, it's interesting because one of the things that Alan was saying was that really where the future is going in terms of the internet, he's saying it's, you know, sharing and collaboration. You know, Google's known for, you know, organising the world's information and making it universally accessible and useful. But, I mean, he's saying basically, you know, I'm here today, which was the other night, and Google's in Australia because, you know, the future is sharing and collaboration and we need to do that. And, you know, Google Maps is just one part of that. So it's interesting. You need to collaborate more. People need to join communities more and start getting out there and doing stuff online. But that's where they see the future going.
All right. And Alan, is he based in Australia?
He is based in Australia. I think the main team's in Sydney. They've got a couple of people. There's an engineering and R&D department in Sydney. I think they've got a couple of people in Melbourne, a couple of people in New Zealand. But that's, I'm assuming, a sales team. It's not so much any engineering sort of people.
Okay, and what else is news from that end of the world? Anything exciting that you think warrants a mention?
Well, yeah, I do. There's a really nice story I heard, which is Lars, a guy called Lars, who is he's the guy that put together Google Maps, I suppose, the original, you know, Google Maps, and put it all together. In 2004, I think he headed out to Australia and did that. But his story is quite interesting, how he got to Google, and I thought I just might mention that because it's a sweet story. But he was working with his brother, and they were compiling bits and pieces of code and doing all sorts of wonderful stuff. And he met a Cuban woman here, and because of all the politics, they just found it really awkward, I suppose, to live here. And they took off travelling. And one of the places they landed was Sydney, and they loved it. They stayed there for like a year or so. Now, in the meantime, his company, his brother and he were putting together this software. It was mapping stuff that they were doing. And Google became really interested in this. And they not only wanted to buy the product, they wanted to buy the man. So buying the man and the product meant that Lars could sort of say, hey, these are the conditions. And one of the conditions he said, he didn't set many, he's a nice guy, but he basically said, I want to work in Sydney. And that's what he got. They basically sent him out there, and I think he was one of the first couple of people out there working in Sydney, but building on what he and his brother had originally done and now Google owns. So nice story, nice to get what you need and have someone help you do that. Can I just tell you something a little bit more about Google Maps? One of the things that R&D in Australia are doing, according to Alan, is there's a lot of data acquisition. They're buying a lot of stuff like, you know, Yellow Pages information and road traffic photos and stuff like that, and they're including that into Maps. So you know, it's supposed to grow and it has to grow rather quickly because there's so much information they need to put into it. So it'll be interesting to see how much they can spit out. I'd love to know what you can do there. You know, maybe you should do a little bit of an experiment at some point and just show me how much you can do there with Google Maps, because we can do everything here. You've heard the stories of the toilets at Google?
No. Tell me about the toilets at Google.
Okay. Well, you know, you go for your little wee thing, but basically you sit down on the seat and it's heated and you think and you jump
what,
up.
What, heated
going, oh,
toilet seat?
Yeah. Hang on. And you're sitting there doing, you know, you jump up and you go, hang on, that's not quite right, because generally when they're, you know, when they're warm, you think, someone's been sitting there a minute ago, I don't want to be sitting there. You jump up and then you realise the thing's heated. Not only that, but there's a master control right there for you. I have a photo to
what?
Show you.
What? A master control?
Yes. There's a little control panel of little things that you can do with the toilet.
So hey, can you surf the net while you're on the toilet at Google?
I suspect so. It's wireless, totally wireless.
You'll have to check that out for me when you're there next time.
I will.
They have a portal in the loo.
But one of the things that was I thought was really cool, going back to, you know, how they treat their employees well, I saw a guy, as we were walking out the door, out, you know, out the building, basically, there was a guy, it's 9:15, so it's not terribly late, but he was sitting there at his PC and he'd fallen asleep, so working quite hard and doing all sorts of stuff, but, you know.
Send us the picture and we'll have to pop it up on the website. All right, Lydia, it's been great. I'll hopefully catch up with you within the next 6 weeks again for the next instalment.
I'm so sorry. You will, because, you know, watch out for WordPress. But before we go, you know, if there's really good developers out there, go and give Google a shot, because they need people in Australia. And I know we've got brilliant, brilliant talent there. So get out there and just do something. Call them.
In another development with Google this week too, Graham, you've got something there which is quite interesting in itself.
Yes, it looks like Google have been filing patents on some technology to do psychological profiles on people.
What?
Based on their behaviour in online games.
Hey, what? More spyware?
More, well, kind of. What they're going to do is they're going to try and work out what sort of person you are based on how you behave in the game. So, if you're an aggressive person, or if you're hostile, if you're dishonest in the game, tells them something about what sort of person you might be, and they can use that to target the right advertisements towards you.
Mm.
Like Yeti games and things like that. How far you throw the penguin, they're going to work out how...
Well, could be something like that. Could be like, more likely the massively multiplayer games, along the lines of World of Warcraft, or even the onlineable games in the PlayStation, Nintendo, and so on.
Oh, cool. Yeah, of course.
So, spooky. Yeah. Big Brother is watching you.
That's exactly right.
Oh, yeah, good. All right, we'll take a break. We'll be back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. The Panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And just in the break there, we had a little bit of news in from Microsoft. They're about to sue Sun over OpenOffice.org that you were talking about earlier, Graham.
Oh, dear. All right, we'll be keeping our eye on that one.
Yeah, good luck with that, Microsoft.
Oh, dear. Yes. Mm. Hey, by the way, any more news on Dig? Because I know that's out of the blue for you, but
there has been no more news. I've been
their website's still up.
It is still up, and I've been actively watching the forums and also the headlines on Dig, but there is...
Just before you go on, the reason we're worried about Dig is because they decided not to ban publishing the decryption details for the new high-definition DVD format.
That's right, Graham. They made a conscious decision and a public decision to ignore a cease and desist letter. So
yeah.
There's been no news at all. The site's still up and there have been no developments. I guess the ball's back in the court.
It's in the legal peoples now, isn't it?
Well, it's back over to the HD DVD licensing administrator as to whether or not they'll take legal
action.
Whether
it's worth the bad publicity of taking down a site like Dig.
Exactly right, yeah.
Okay. You got an iPod? Any of you guys?
Not an iPod as such.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you've got an iPod and a pacemaker, ooh, you're in trouble.
I don't have a pacemaker either, so I'm right.
No. News this week, iPods, I think we talked about it in the news, iPods can cause cardiac implantable pacemakers to malfunction. A 17-year-old high school student presented a study to a whole bunch of heart specialists last week and said that if you held your iPod just 2 inches from a chest for 5 to 10 seconds, you could create electrical interference, which did nasty things to those who were relying on the pacemaker thing.
Well, that's a worrying one. And, of course, you're a lot closer than 2 inches if you've got your iPod in your shirt pocket.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, if it's dangling around your neck if you're out for a jog or something.
Absolutely.
Like that.
Absolutely.
Mm. So you've got to think, that they only tested iPods. It's not really a go at iPods. It's just having that sort of technology, I think, hanging around your chest.
Because I suspect so. The iPod wouldn't be worse than any other type of that technology.
Yeah, I see those very slimline clam phones that people use, mobile phones, they quite often stick those in their top pockets too. Now, just put it near your hi-fi system at home and you'll hear the nit-nit-nit that it makes, you know, that in itself, if it's radiating near something pacemaker-ish.
I have to say, I've got a bit of a gripe against not just the medical industry, but the whole range of industries that don't make their products immune to radio emissions that are outside what they should be receiving.
Mm.
So I think this might be one for the people who, not so much for the iPod people to worry about, but it should be something that the manufacturers of the medical technology to worry about, to make sure that they're immune to that sort of interference.
I would have thought that mobile phones would be much more likely than a portable music player.
Well, you'd think
so.
Yeah, because they're designed to transmit radio frequency energy.
But maybe the pacemaker designer has taken that into account, but has forgotten to take into account the different type of radiation that you might get from a hard disk-based music player.
Possibly.
Hey,
possibly
now, Robert's so. Still here from the WIA, still at the moment. Hey, we talked to you recently about BPL, broadcasting power lines, and that sort of interference. Is there any developments in that side, just briefly?
Well, there's been a few more trial sites that have sprung up over the period of time, but, nothing has really been pushed out big time commercially. And, and in fact, one of the recent news releases that came to air last week was that Motorola was pulling out of some of their BPL development.
Yes.
So,
well, the initial trials were fairly scathing about the amount of interference they produced, weren't they?
That's right. And the ACMA went out and investigated and found that high levels of harmful interference were, in fact, being emitted by the trials. So
you'd wonder why you would go forward with technology that's shown to be harmful in that way.
Yeah. Well, they're trying software and hardware notching, but unless they can pull it off properly, then it will interfere.
Yeah, interference is a big problem, whether it's your pacemaker or whether it's your stereo system, I guess, really. It all comes down to nice, clean devices. Now, paper. The old piece of paper. Tell us about what...
the bit of paper that the technology promised that we wouldn't need paper anymore. We'd have paperless office.
You should see the studio here. It's just littered with pieces of paper in front of everybody in all shapes and sizes. There's
no trees were harmed in the making of this program.
Yeah, don't believe it, buddy.
A South Korean company called LG Philips LCD has developed an A4-sized colour electronic paper.
Yeah. Now, tell me about this. It's something which retains its the image on it.
That's right.
Even when it's not powered. Is that how I understand that?
That's right, yeah. It uses power when the image changes and then doesn't use power when the image is static on it. So you have power going to it to change the image, to go to the next page, for example. Mm-hmm. And then while it's sitting there displaying that page, it's not using any power. So it's very energy efficient.
And it's flexible?
It's flexible.
Bends.
Yep. It's
how do you write on it, do you reckon? Like a little pen or something, and you've got to plug it in?
Well, I think it's mainly a display thing rather than an input device.
So it's not really paper then. Someone's pulling out proverbial.
Well, it's paper. I mean, you don't write in your favourite book.
How thin is it? No, that's true.
It's
my kids do.
300 micrometres, which is 0.3 millimetres.
So it's equivalent to a little sheet of paper.
Yeah, and it's A4 sized, and it can display up to 4,096 colours.
And how do you get it to change the content grain? Do you tap it, or do you... Does it say?
This is just the display technology, so it would have to connect to a device that would have that technology.
Or storage device.
You'd connect this to your portable, handheld PC or something of that nature, or perhaps even to your phone. And
so this is the start of things to come, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so that the experience of reading something, instead of having it reading on a lit-up screen, can be a bit more like reading it off a sheet of paper.
Mm-hmm.
So
excellent.
For those people that print out everything before they read it.
Now, this was touted years ago, too. I wonder what's kept them.
It's been along the way. It's been tricky technology to develop, from what I hear. But, it sounds like this South Korean company might be on the track of it.
Very good. Very good. All right. Now, Dr. Ron, you were going to talk about some financial gains you made surfing the internet just recently.
I am $25 richer as of today.
Ah, you're sharing the coffees tonight, then.
I am, for surfing the internet. Have you noticed these sites that are available to web surfers everywhere where they tell you that you can get paid to click or get paid to surf?
I've even seen ads on television for these sorts of sites.
Graham, there are ads on Australian television that say go to email cash and places like that.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I undertook...
Obviously go to the wrong sites.
I undertook to do a science experiment on behalf of the team.
Oh, yes.
And all our listeners there. For the last year, I actually enrolled in two sites. One was Email Cash, which can be found at emailcash.com.au. The other one is called Pure Profile. Try not to pop my P's. Pure Profile, which can be found at pureprofile.com.
Now, are they both Australian? One, obviously.
They are both Australian. What they are is online survey sites, and they ask for information. They ask for you to complete online surveys. Some of them, like Email Cash, they'll send you maybe one or two or half a dozen emails a week, and you have to click the links in those emails. The way Email Cash works is you clock up points, and after you get, say, 3,000 points, a point might be equal to a cent, and after you get up to about, say, 3,000 points... You can then say, well, I want to...
$3 or something.
Or $30. I want to convert this now to dollars. Or I want to buy something in an online store, for example.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I did an experiment. I've been running with it for about a year. I'm happy to say that Pure Profile, I've just put $25 in my bank account.
After a year?
A year.
I'm doing the numbers on that. That's $25. About $1.90 a month. Is that about right?
My response to that question, Andrew, is don't give up your day job. However, I thought it would be an interesting experiment. With Pure Profile, I signed up on the 30th of May. May 2006. I've just got in my notes here. They paid me last week. I received a direct credit into my bank account for $25. And my current balance with Pure Profile is another $25. So I'm ready for another payment, which is
good. Now, I presume you could make more money than that if you were to devote more time to filling in extra surveys or clicking on more links.
That's exactly it, Graham. It's spot on. If you devote the time and you go online and you keep your profile updated...
So how many hours a week would you have spent on this over that year?
I would say less than an hour a week, maybe something like 10 or 15 minutes a week. That's just opening emails every day going, oh, this is an email cache email.
So if you made a decision to two nights a week devote half an hour...
Well, you could make probably a little bit of pocket money, which would be good.
Good for the kids.
Mm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there you go. That's getting paid to web surf.
Hey,
does it work? The answer is yes.
And what type of websites do they take you to?
Andrew, they're all online shopping ones. They're consumer interest ones where they're trying to solicit information from you.
Are they valid sites? Like, as in they don't put nasty things on your machine,
no.
Like cookies and things?
My experience is that they don't put nasty things on your machine.
That's good, because I just said the kids could do it, and I wouldn't want them going to places which were not above board.
No, that's exactly right. No, they're all reputable online shopping type websites.
Have you ever bought anything from one of the ads that you've been directed to?
No.
Right. So kids, go and get mum and dad's Visa card and off you go shopping. I think it's a wonderful thing to do in time for
Christmas. Don't say that.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Cool! Interesting!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Son of a... Oh!
LG has released the first dual Blu-ray and HD DVD drive for your PC.
Do tell.
Had to happen.
It did have to happen. It's a monumental name. Just hang on to your seats here. The LG GGW H10NI Super Multi Blue BD Drive HD DVD reader. From here on in, called the Gadget of the Week. can write to 25 gigabyte single and 50 gigabyte double layer Blu-ray disc media. It's also an HD DVD reader.
What was the model number?
I won't. Press rewind if you want to hear that model number. That model name again. It's bizarre, isn't it? It's Big Hook, of course, that in addition to reading and writing Blu-ray discs, it can also play HD DVD ROMs. And you'll pay dearly for the convenience, though, because its current list price is US$1,199.
Ouch.
LG says it'll ship the drives to retail stores in June.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
And as we mentioned earlier on in the show, photobucket.com is going to be our website of the week because everyone wants to do party invitations. Everybody wants to do websites, all sorts of little things like that. And you need stock photos that you can download free of charge, using your school project, using anything you want to do without paying a fortune for royalties for professional photographies like Getty Images, things like that. If you visit, and you can upload your own things there too and show your family and friends on PhotoBucket. So, I'm sorry, Graham, let me do that again.
That's what I've seen people using it for, just to, throw your photos up so you can put your photo, link to it in a forum or something like that.
Yeah. So you've got all sorts of good options there to use some PhotoBucket. So if you, I had a look at it for the first time this week. I thought, wow, that's a terrific little service that they're offering. So if you want to share your photos around or you want to download some stuff, go and have a look at photobucket.com.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
Graham, you've got a GPS navigator, don't you?
Yes, I do.
I thought that I would share this odd spot with you all this week. In the latest intergalactic leap of stupidity when it comes to relying on directions of GPS navigators, this is better than our bridge out saga, Andrew, where people are driving off the bridge. In the United Kingdom, Paula Seely, 20 years of age, said her TomTom sat-nav directed her straight onto a railway line where she was almost killed by a speeding train. Luckily for Paula, she managed to leap clear just seconds before the train ploughed into her Renault Clio at over 100 kilometres an hour.
So she had time to get out?
I thought the sat-nav knew where we were going, said Paula. I just followed the directions it was giving me. It's not my fault I wound up on a train track.
Yeah, so use a bit of common sense, even if you are using the sat-nav.
The Darwin Award should kick in about now.
British Transport Police are investigating the incident. At this stage, there is no evidence that the TomTom device was at fault.
It's funny, actually. I was listening to local media here, and there's been a bit of an onslaught of people being towed out of bogs and things like that. Even in country Victoria here, where someone was blatantly following their navigation system. They went down a road.
That happened down southwest coast somewhere.
That's the one. And the appropriate police officer being interviewed on the radio at the time said, I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. So come on, guys. Use a bit of common sense when using your TomToms.
I think we'll be talking about this in a future program, I think.
Oh, I think so. We must get someone in talking about navigation devices.
Absolutely.
Next week, speaking of getting people in, Mark Mayer is going to return to the studio here and talk about aviation.
Hey, I'm not.
Dr. Ron, you bring your leave pass.
I'll put my apologies in.
Yep, yes. But that'll be a bit of fun. So stay tuned to us. Thank you to Robert Broomhead for popping in, talking to us tonight about amateur radio and stuff. We learned a lot. And don't forget our competition. Visit the website. Just call in and register your information there on the phone number 1300 664 882, and we've got 5 books to give away to our listeners. Doesn't matter, just call in at any time. You don't have to be the first. We'll just pick some randomly from our system here, from wherever you might be listening, from Cairns down here to Melbourne, or on the pod, anywhere in the world for that matter. All right, you've been listening to Graham Callaghan, Dr. Ron, Andrew McComb, our guest tonight, Robert Broomhead. Until this time next week, it's bye for now.
Tech Talk Radio is brought to you each and every week by a band of dedicated professionals from within the broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer and host Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Sir Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins. Our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Production facilities are courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night from 8 p.m. The producers wish to thank all the stations that are taking the show, including 3WBC, 3XX, Cairns FM and 4KZ. for syndication, sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit the website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.